The Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Okay, let's unpack this. We are diving deep today into, well, a really influential book, one that shaped how many people think about history and global inequality. It's Jared Diamond's Guns, Germs, and Steel.
Oh, yeah, it's a huge one, a Pulitzer winner, and it tries to answer this incredibly profound question, doesn't it? Why did wealth and power end up distributed the way they are today?
Right. Why was it Europeans and Asians who ended up, you know, conquering or colonizing other parts of the world and not the other way around?
Exactly. And it's fascinating because this whole massive inquiry, this huge book, it all started from a pretty simple question someone asked him in the field.
Yeah, I love the part. It wasn't some abstract academic puzzle initially.
No, not at all. It was a politician from New Guinea named Yali, and he just asked Diamond, basically, why is it that you white people developed so much cargo?
Yeah.
Meaning, you know, technology, material goods, and brought it here, but we black people had little cargo of our own.
Cargo, yeah. Such a simple word for, well, everything. All the stuff, the power, the whole system. So our mission here today is to kind of distill Diamond's argument, which is really dense, draws from biology, geography, history.
All sorts of fields.
And give you the scientific core of his answer so you can walk away understanding the deep roots of global inequality without, you know, reading thousands of pages of history.
And starting with Yali's question is so important ethically. It immediately shifts the whole thing away from, frankly, racist explanations that were common for centuries.
Right. No innate superiority stuff.
None of that. Diamond's whole argument is designed to systematically dismantle those ideas and say, look, the answer lies in the environment, in geography, it's scientific.
Which makes his background really key, doesn't it? He's not your typical historian.
Not at all. He's actually a professor of geography and physiology at UCLA. His specialties are things like evolutionary biology and biogeography.
Biogeography. Okay, now, what exactly is that?
It's basically the study of why species live where they live. You know, how they got distributed across the planet. So Diamond applies that scientific lens to us, to human societies.
Ah, so he's looking at us almost like any other species, analyzing the environmental cards we were dealt.
Precisely. What raw materials did different environments offer? Not focusing on, like, great leaders or cultural genius, initially anyway. It's about the environmental stage.
So the core idea, the central thesis, is that the distribution of power, it really comes down to geographical luck.
That's the heart of it. And to grasp that, he introduces this really useful framework. He says we need to separate out the immediate reasons for conquest from the deeper underlying causes.
Okay, so he calls them proximate causes and ultimate causes.
Exactly. Proximate causes are the immediate things you see. Think Pizarro showing up in South America.
Right. The guns, the steel swords, the armor, and the germs, which we'll get to, those are proximate.
Yes, they're the how. But Diamond says those are just symptoms. The real question is, why did Pizarro have those things? That takes you to the ultimate causes.
So the ultimate causes are the root factors. Way back.
Way back. These are the long-term environmental factors. Things like what wild plants and animals were available to be domesticated in different regions. What was the actual shape and orientation of the continents? These things, he argues, set everything in motion thousands of years earlier.
Okay, that makes sense. Sort of the deep infrastructure behind the immediate event.
That's a great way to put it, the deep infrastructure.
And to really illustrate this chain of cause and effect, he uses that dramatic historical moment, the collision at Cajamarca in 1532.
Oh, it's an incredible case study. You have Francisco Pizarro leading just 168 Spaniards.
Just 168.
Against the Inca Emperor Atahualpa, who commanded this massive army, maybe 80,000 soldiers.
And the outcome was, well, shockingly one-sided.
Utterly. Pizarro's victory was incredibly swift, incredibly brutal. And it came down to those proximate factors we mentioned. The Spanish had steel armor, Inca weapons, you know, clubs and stone axes, just couldn't penetrate it.
Plus steel swords for offense and horses.
Horses were huge, both for mobility and, frankly, the shock value. Imagine never having seen a horse before, let alone one carrying an armored soldier charging at you.
Terrifying. And beyond the military tech, there was also information, right? Organizations.
Absolutely crucial. The Spaniards came from a literate society with centuries of experience in political organization, funding large expeditions, map making, sharing information across vast distances. Pizarro knew about the Incas. Atahualpa knew almost nothing about Spain or Europeans.
That information asymmetry is huge.
But maybe the deadliest weapon Pizarro brought wasn't even wielded consciously. It was disease.
Ah, the germs part of the title.
Exactly. Smallpox, a disease that had evolved over centuries in Eurasia from close contact with domesticated animals, had actually arrived in the Americas before Pizarro got to Cajamarca.
So it had already done damage.
Massive damage. It had swept through, killed the previous Inca emperor, sparked a civil war over the succession. It basically destabilized the entire empire before Pizarro even laid eyes on Atahualpa.
Wow. Okay, so those are the proximate causes laid bare. Guns, steel, horses, writing, germs.
Right. And the rest of Diamond's book, The Real Deep Dive, is answering, why did Pizarro's society develop those things while Atahualpa's didn't? Why the huge disparity?
And to answer that, you said we have to go way back.
All the way back. To about 11,000 BCE, the end of the last ice age. Dian makes a crucial point here. At that time, pretty much all human societies around the globe were roughly equivalent.
Everyone was a hunter-gatherer.
Everyone, living in small, nomadic bands. There's no evidence of any significant difference in, like, innate intelligence or potential between populations anywhere on Earth. We all started from the same place.
Okay, so starting line is equal. What caused the paths to diverge so dramatically?
The first massive turning point, the ultimate cause number one, was the shift from hunting and gathering to food production, agriculture, what Diamond calls farmer power.
Why was farming such a game changer?
Well, think about it. Hunting and gathering, you're constantly moving, searching for food. It's hard to store food, hard to support large populations. Agriculture changes everything because, for the first time, you can produce more food than you immediately need.
Surplus.
Surplus, that's the magic word. Surplus food means you can settle down in one place. Populations can grow much denser. And crucially, not everyone has to be involved in getting food anymore.
So you get specialists.
Exactly. You get artisans making tools, priests organizing society, bureaucrats managing things, and maybe most importantly, soldiers to protect the surplus or grab more land, and eventually rulers to oversee it all. Surplus leads to specialization, which leads to complexity, states, and eventually technological innovation like metalworking.
No surplus, no specialists, no state, no steel swords for Pizarro.
You got it. That's the chain. And this is where the first huge dose of geographic luck comes in, the environmental lottery.
Okay, who won this lottery?
The clear winner, initially, was a region we now call the Fertile Crescent. That arc of land stretching from modern-day Egypt up through Syria and down into Iraq.
Why there?
Because, just by chance, that specific region happened to have the highest concentration anywhere in the world of wild plants that were suitable for domestication. Think wild wheat, barley, peas, lentils. Highly nutritious, easy to grow, easy to store grains and pulses.
So they just had better raw materials to start farming with.
Much better. But that was only half the equation. Just as importantly, the Fertile Crescent and the wider Eurasian landmass also contained the wild ancestors of almost all the major domestical mammals.
Cows, sheep, goats, pigs, horses.
Yep. We kind of take them for granted like they were always destined to be farm animals. But Diamond shows that domesticable large mammals are incredibly rare.
How so? Why can't you just tame, like, a zebra or a bear?
Well, he introduces this brilliant concept called the Anna Karenina Principle. It's borrowed from Tolstoy's novel, you know, the first line. All happy families are alike. Each unhappy family is unhappy in its own way.
Okay. How does that apply to animals?
For a wild animal species to be successfully domesticated, it has to possess a whole suite of positive traits. It needs the right diet, can't be too picky. It needs to grow relatively quickly. It needs a reasonably calm disposition. You don't want angry bears in your barn.
Right, that makes sense.
It also needs to be willing to breed readily in captivity. And crucially, it often helps if it has a kind of internal social hierarchy that humans can tap into, like leading a herd.
So the Anna Karenina principle means?
It means that failure on any single one of those requirements makes the animal basically undomesticable. Most large mammals fail on at least one count. Zebras are too nervous and prone to panic. Bears are too solitary and dangerous. You get the idea.
So it's not that people elsewhere weren't trying. It's that the local candidates just weren't suitable.
Exactly. And the numbers are stunning. Out of all the potential large mammal candidates worldwide, only 14 species were ever successfully domesticated before the 20th century. Eurasia got 13 of them.
13 out of 14. Wow. And the Americas.
The Americas got just one. The llama and alpaca found in the Andes. Useful for wool and packing, sure, but you can't ride a llama into battle. You can't hitch it to a heavy plow to cultivate vast fields.
That's a massive difference. More food, more power for plowing.
More manure for fertilizer, more transport capability, and, chillingly, more diseases.
Right. That brings us back to the germs, the lethal gift of livestock.
This is maybe the most sobering part of the argument.
Yeah.
Living in close proximity to dense populations of domesticated animals, cows, pigs, sheep, goats, chickens, created essentially a giant petri dish in Eurasia.
How so?
Well, many of the deadliest epidemic diseases in human history actually originated as diseases in those domestic animals. Microbes jumped the species barrier. Measles likely came from cattle rinderpest. Smallpox might be related to cowpox. Influenza has links to pigs and ducks.
So by domesticating animals, Eurasians inadvertently bred new diseases.
Exactly. And over centuries, millennia even, Eurasian populations were constantly exposed to these pathogens. Terrible epidemics swept through, but over time, survivors developed genetic and immunological resistance. Natural selection at work.
They built up immunity the hard way.
The very hard way. But when Europeans arrived in the Americas or Australia or Southern Africa, they encountered populations who had not co-evolved with these specific diseases because they didn't have those domestic animals. They had zero immunity.
So the diseases just ripped through them.
Like wildfire. Historians estimate that old world diseases, smallpox, measles, influenza, typhus, killed up to 95% of the pre-Columbian population of the Americas. 95%.
That's almost unimaginable. It's biological warfare without even trying.
Precisely. It wasn't intentional genocide in most cases, but the effect was catastrophic. It completely shattered societies, emptied landscapes, and made conquest far, far easier for the European colonizers. Far more effective than guns or steel alone.
Okay, so we have agriculture leading to surplus and specialization. We have domestic animals providing power, food, and germs. But Eurasia is huge. How did these advantages spread across such a vast area?
That's the final piece of the environmental puzzle, and it's fascinating. It's about the shape of the continents themselves. The tilted axes, as Diamond calls it.
Tilted axes? What does that mean?
Look at a world map. Eurasia is fundamentally oriented east-west. It's much wider than it is tall.
Mm-hmm.
If you travel from, say, Spain to China, you're largely staying within similar latitudes.
Okay, right, east-west.
And similar latitudes generally mean similar climates, similar day lengths, similar seasons. Why does that matter?
For farming. Crops and animals are adapted to specific conditions.
Exactly. A crop like wheat, domesticated in the Fertile Crescent, could spread relatively easily eastward and westward across Eurasia because the climate conditions it needed were found across that vast belt. Same for livestock. Ideas like writing or the wheel could also travel along those established trade and migration routes.
It's like a geographic superhighway for diffusion.
A perfect analogy. Now contrast that with the Americas or with sub-Saharan Africa. What's their main orientation?
North-south. They're much taller than they are wide.
Right. And moving north-south means crossing drastically different climate zones. Try moving a crop domesticated in, say, Mexico down to the Andes. Or up into North America, you hit deserts, tropical rainforests, huge temperature swings.
Major barriers.
Huge barriers. The same climate barrier slowed the spread of the llama out of the Andes. It slowed the spread of agriculture from Mexico. It meant that innovations that happened in one place tended to stay locked in that region. There wasn't that easy east-west corridor for things to spread quickly across the entire continent, like in Eurasia.
Wow, so even if agriculture had popped up independently somewhere else, it wouldn't have spread as easily.
Probably not nearly as effectively or as widely. That north-south axis acted like a massive brake on diffusion compared to Eurasia's accelerator.
That's a really powerful geographic insight. It connects everything together.
It really does. It shows how these deep environmental factors, the initial distribution of plants and animals, and the orientation of the continents, created this enormous head start for Eurasian societies, completely independent of any supposed differences in the people themselves.
So let's try to pull this together. What are the big takeaways for us thinking about this today? You mentioned historical humility.
Yeah, I think that's the absolute core message. Understanding guns, germs, and steel should make us incredibly humble about historical outcomes. The societies that ended up winning, historically speaking, weren't necessarily smarter or better or more virtuous.
They were luckier.
They were beneficiaries of a massive environmental lottery played out over millennia. They inherited better biological tools and lived on a continent shaped in a way that allowed those tools to spread. Recognizing that should fundamentally change how you view global inequality and poverty today. It wasn't preordained by talent. It was heavily shaped by geography.
And Diamond actually shows this playing out in a kind of natural experiment, right? With the Moriori and the Maori.
Oh, that's such a compelling example. You have two groups of people, the Moriori and the Maori, who came from the exact same Polynesian ancestral stock. So biologically identical initially.
Okay, same origins, but they settled different islands.
Right. The Moriori settled the Chatham Islands, small, isolated, relatively cold, too cold for the tropical crops their Polynesian ancestors brought. So they couldn't develop intensive agriculture. They reverted to being a small, peaceful hunter-gatherer society. They even renounced warfare.
And the Maori.
They settled the much larger, warmer islands of New Zealand. There, their ancestral crops could flourish. They developed intensive agriculture, which supported dense populations, specialization, including specialized warrior classes, complex political structures, and, well, a pretty warlike culture focused on competition and conquest.
So same people, different environments lead to totally different societies.
Totally different trajectories. And tragically, when the agricultural technologically advanced, numerous Maori eventually encountered the small, peaceful hunter-gatherer Moriori on the Chatham Islands.
It wasn't a fair fight.
It was a slaughter. The Maori conquered and virtually exterminated the Moriori. Diamond uses this as stark proof. Same people, different environments lead directly to one group becoming conquerors and the other victims. It's a brutal illustration of environmental influence over destiny.
It really drives home that point about environment, not inherent traits.
Absolutely.
Another big takeaway seems to be about thinking in systems, using that proximate versus ultimate cause framework.
Yes, that's such a useful mental tool, and not just for history. When you look at complex problems of the world today, maybe political instability in a region or persistent poverty or even something like climate change impact.
Don't just look at the immediate crisis, the proximate cause.
Exactly. Ask yourself, What are the deeper underlying ultimate causes? What historical path led here? What are the environmental or geographic or economic structures that created the conditions for this problem to arise? Trace the chain of causation back. It gives you a much richer, more complete understanding than just focusing on the symptoms.
It's about looking for those foundational factors.
Foundational factors. That's the key.
Okay, that leads us towards a final thought, something maybe a bit provocative based on all this. Diamond shows how our entire complex world, all the technology, the cities, the global economy, it's all built on a surprisingly narrow foundation, isn't it?
It really is. It rests ultimately on the food surplus generated by a handful of lucky plant and animal domestications that happened thousands of years ago in specific places. That agricultural base allows everything else.
It feels kind of fragile when you put it like that.
It is. Our whole civilization is perched atop this ecological pyramid that started with geographic luck. And that raises a really important question for us now.
Which is?
Well, if our current prosperity is so deeply dependent on the environmental stability that allowed that agriculture to flourish in the first place, what does Diamond's work suggest about the ultimate risks we face from things like climate change, massive biodiversity loss, ecosystem collapse?
If we destabilize the environmental foundation.
What happens to the incredibly complex global society we've built on top of it? If the environment set the initial conditions for power and inequality 13,000 years ago, what could major changes to that environment mean for our future?
That's definitely something to mull over. How stable is the foundation we take for granted?
It connects the deep past right into the heart of our most pressing modern challenges.
Wow. We've certainly covered a huge sweep of history and ideas today, trying to get to the core of Diamond's argument about where global inequality really comes from.
It's a powerful framework. Definitely challenges a lot of assumptions and provides this evidence-based, non-racist explanation for one of humanity's biggest, most persistent questions.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We hope it gave you a clear understanding of the main ideas in Guns, Germs, and Steel. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.